Welcome to this episode of the Security Clearance Careers Podcast, Clearcast, your source for security clearance, intelligence community, espionage, national security, and defense contracting updates. In our exclusive interviews with intelligence community and government leaders.
Hi, this is Lenny Kaiser with ClearanceJobs.com, and welcome to Diversity in the Security Clearance Process. Creating better equity and inclusion across our national security workforce is a key issue and topic. And there was recently a report released by RAND about a diverse and trusted workforce examining elements that could contribute to the potential for bias and sources of inequity in national security personnel vetting. Not the first time RAND has tackled this topic, and not the first time we've seen the government use some research dollars and investment to explore this topic. Really excited today to have Sina Begley, who is a senior international defense researcher with RAND Corporation, and also Jessica Page, a social scientist with RAND Corporation. They helped author this report, have been behind a lot of research around this topic, so really glad to have them with me today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having us, Lindy.
RAND is known for its research across different sectors. I think folks might be surprised to know that you've done a number of studies around the security clearance process, particularly personnel vetting. Also some unexpected topics around national security, which is diversity and diversity hiring in national security. You've covered it a few different ways. Can you just kind of give me an introduction to this most recent white paper, why you're doing this research, kind of the key overarching questions you were asking?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks again for having us, Lindy. For this study, what's interesting about it is RAND's done a couple studies in this space before, as you pointed out, but they were self-generated, really. So they were RAND research that was exploratory in this topic. So this is the first time we've done a project that was actually funded by the government looking at kind of this question of the potential for bias and inequity in the personnel vetting process. And the government itself said they were interested in looking at the topic. The other interesting aspect of this, our prior topics looked at the potential for bias and inequity when it came to race and ethnicity. That was one. And it was really mostly a sort of a desk study, right, of documents that were out there, understanding what literature was. But it hadn't actually spoken. We didn't have interviews as part of those exploratory studies. So we hadn't talked to people in government. We didn't talk to experts in equity and diversity as part of those kind of small seed studies. So what's great about this is the government funded us to do this. Initially, we were going to just expand on that prior exploratory research on the race and ethnicity aspect. And the government, the Performance Accountability Council Program Management Office that funded this study, said, no, we'd like you to actually look broader than race and ethnicity. We'd like you to look at gender identity, and neurodivergence. The neurodivergence being examples of it, autism, ADD, ADHD, that type of thing, to look at those components and see if there's a potential for bias or at least inequity in experience for candidates that fall into those realms and into those bins. And again, in some cases, those candidates fall into multiple categories. So looking at that process, looking at what those experiences might be like, and just highlighting some of those experiences and potential opportunities for the government to think about what it might do differently in the process. So that's really where this came from. We started out smaller, got more expansive in what we were looking at, and really learned some very interesting pieces of things when it came to these processes, both from how the government addresses the topic currently and what they're doing moving forward, and then how a candidate may be experiencing the process and what they've sort of reported, at least anecdotally to us, when it came to some of these topics.
I love that because there are those two pieces of it. You have the government angle and the candidate angle. And I always appreciate when we really dig into some research around these topics because we get to see that. And that's another piece of this, that we do look at this national security clearance process, that we have the recruiting side of it, where you know a lot about the candidate, and the security clearance side of it, where you potentially know a lot about the candidate that could contribute to a lot of issues around discrimination because of those diversity statuses. The security clearance process dredges up a lot of things that the hiring process doesn't necessarily particularly want to know about. And I know your research kind of spoke to that. How do you deal with these different lanes where in the security clearance process, you're finding out information, but you're not necessarily segmenting out and knowing who's in that population?
It's a great question and something we thought a lot about and talked a lot about while we were working on the project. And I think it's definitely a challenge to consider in the security clearance process. So on the one hand, right, some people argue that like if you're collecting this information during the process, it's going to lead to more bias, more avenues for discrimination. On the other hand, not collecting demographic information like race, gender, sexual orientation, neurodivergent status can tracking it, then it's hard to identify sources of bias or instances of discrimination that happen. And so there is a real tension there. And one of the things that we recommend is trying to collect that information separately. So in a space, in a separate survey where, you know, investigators may not have access to it directly, but where you could then link it to outcomes and experiences, you could really identify any patterns in either the outcomes of the applicants or their experiences during the clearance process that may be problematic. And again, there may be unintentional things happening during the clearance process. They're collecting a lot of information about folks that's very personal. And, you know, there's a lot of space for investigators to insert personal biases inadvertently. And so just being able to keep track of that, perhaps through a separate survey, could be really helpful to identifying patterns for folks going through the process.
Yeah, I just add to Jessica's point too, just because that information is not collected doesn't mean it isn't known. It isn't seen by an investigator or an adjudicator. We talk about this a bit in the report, partly because of the information that the candidate has to provide, right, in an SF86 form. So where you grew up or your name, your relatives' names can tell, you know, about someone's background. You say, when you talk about gender and gender identity, I may have a name that is, you know, reflective of one gender, but a birth sex that was a different gender. And I may be married to someone who has a name that appears to be the same gender as me. So it's all of those things where this is potentially knowable in the process. So just because you're not officially collecting it doesn't mean that it's not known by the investigator and the adjudicator and couldn't potentially at least be something that they are aware of, whether, again, as Jessica points out, intentional or unintentionally could impact at least the experience that the individual has. Again, we talk about anecdotal examples of those, if not the actual adjudication of how someone goes through the process.
Yeah. And so talk about, like, you do a big study like this, you're getting basic observations and recommendations that come out of that. So can you just kind of give an overview of what some of those recommendations and observations were? And are there any kind of low-hanging fruit areas where the government could be acting or you see opportunities today?
Sure. Well, one thing, you know, building off the last question is that collecting of demographic information in a separate survey or process that, again, is separate from the FS86, but allows for the information to be collected and bias to be tracked, whether it be intentional or unintentional bias. So that's a big issue. Another is to implement standardized and tailored training for investigators. We got kind of varying reports about the type of training and the quality of training that's available. It would be great to sort of build out this area and ensure that everyone is having access, all the investigators have access to the same types of training that is, you know, updated and covers a number of potential different types of bias, and that this training really be developed in conjunction with DEI experts. There's been a lot of research that's shown, for instance, that some types of DEI training work better than others. Mandatory training where you just sit people down at a computer screen may not be as effective as sort of voluntary training where people feel like they're bought into the process, where management is involved. So, you know, sorting out some of those sorts of issues as the training is developed and refined to make sure that it's most effective is also helpful. And then we talk about potential revisions to the FS86 as well to improve the process. And I'll turn it over to Sina to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So that was one of the things we looked at is, again, the process, right? The paperwork, the guidelines, right? The structure of the security clearance process, and then the human element of the process. And so that's really where we tried to think about what can manifest in the paperwork and the process and anything that might be able to at least be reviewed in that, and then the human element, which gets to some of the training that we talked about with our recommendations. So on the forms, that was one of the pieces we said, is to at least relook the information that's provided in the SF86, which happens actually on, you know, every 3 years, the government would have to, does have to review and validate and resubmit all the SF forms. So look at that information and how things are being requested. Is all that information necessary? Are there clarified that can be provided, et cetera, when it comes to that. And then similarly, the very basis of adjudications for security clearances is the Security Executive Agent Directive 4, SEED 4, known as the Adjudicative Guidelines. And so again, looking at those guidelines, and at least with that lens to understand, are there any places where they can either be misinterpreted, applied by someone in an inequitable way? Ultimately, we understand the whole purpose of the process is to ensure someone's trustworthy, and you don't want to lose lose that aspect of the process as you evaluate those guidelines, but at least going through that conscientious effort of saying, are there spaces where the guidelines themselves are creating an inequitable experience and potentially result for someone who otherwise would be a perfectly trustworthy candidate, but there's wiggle room because of the subjectivity of the guidelines. And as you know, the whole person concept, the process is built in to be somewhat subjective with the ultimate goal of ensuring that the person is in fact trustworthy and can remain so.
It's such a human process. I mean, that's one of the things we kind of always talk about over at Clearance Jobs. And, you know, we get dinged from this from a data standpoint because they're like, you have all these people asking questions on the Clearance Jobs blog or forums. I know Rand has done some studies into that too. And like, they'll ask a question. Well, they're expecting a response and you can't actually get a response, right? Because every individual case is unique and every case is studied uniquely. But we do need to apply some data sets and best practices around this because you can look if you're looking across the populations and see some trend lines. And we know that from separate surveys we've done about mental health and clearances and drug use considerations. There are differences there, and there are some areas where more diverse applicants do come across those adjudicative guidelines differently. If you have foreign-born parents, you're going to be a lot more scared to complete the SF-86 because of the foreign influence, foreign preference things. So there are some trend lines there. And I wanted to go back to the training piece of it because that's near and dear to my heart, like looking at background investigators. Also, because I have written about this study when it first came out, caught off the presses. I have to like do the hot takes quick and then I get the experts on later on. And I had several background investigators message me. I think I wrote more of an op-ed on it saying like, hey, I think one of the opportunities I see from your research is saying like, hey, let's maybe apply some better training for background investigators. Several background investigators emailed me and said, we already get training on this. And I was like, do better. But like, so I'm curious to see like what your thought was on that training piece of it for background investigators and some of the takeaways there.
Yeah. So we do point this out in the report. There is a cognitive bias training that happens. We are not saying that there isn't a cognitive bias training, but to a person that we spoke to about training, there was no, including the elements responsible for training, there was no sort of dedicated training, especially sort of specific scenario-based training for what someone might encounter as an investigator when it comes to sort of people with diverse backgrounds, whether it's cultural or gender identity, or again, especially neurodivergence. That's probably the area that's least sort of focused on and studied right now when it comes to some of those pieces. So when we finished this study, that was the case. And we even mentioned in the study that there were some exploratory efforts that the government was looking at, where they had some pilots that had happened that were actually seen as very beneficial and helpful, and they were trying to roll that out more throughout the population. So since the study happened, and we're not just talking about investigators, right? Our study recommended training like this for investigators, quality reviewers who are kind of the check on investigators, including that do like check rides when an interview is happening and give feedback in real time, and adjudicators, right? So the whole process is at least aware of what you're encountering or what you might encounter. So the first time that someone's sort of interacting with someone who is quite different from them, because our investigators come from varied backgrounds as well, right? And have varied experiences with a diverse elements of the population. Some have more experience with it, some have less. So creating that baseline standard of expectation of here's what you might encounter, and just preparing them for that. So the first time isn't an actual, you know, security clearance interview with either the subject or a neighbor or a family member. So that's our recommendation. The good news on this related to this topic is the government's moving out on this. And even as we were finalizing, so we'd finished our research, but even as we'd finalized our report, there were actions the government had taken in a number of these spaces. And we tried to acknowledge that even though there's sort of a cutoff time, right? So one is on the investigation side. So the government has updated its investigative standards now for investigators and for adjudicators. I'm sorry, it's training standards to include elements of equity and bias training as it pertains to personnel vetting. So looking specifically at that, not just cognitive bias in a general experience, but looking at related to sort of the DEIA question and incorporating that. So that's a part of the standards. Now, of course, it's implementation. That's always the challenge and what that looks like. But the government is moving out on that. And I know, you know, DCSA in particular has spoken about really where they're prioritizing this area, and they've rolled that out and are implementing it throughout the personnel vetting population. Again, not just the investigators, but more broadly. So that's on the investigation side. You also talked about low-hanging fruit. So as we were doing this study, the government was updating being not the SF86, but as you know, there is a new form coming out eventually, the personal vetting questionnaire, right? And that'll be kind of replacing all of the standard forms when it comes to personnel vetting. And so that PVQ actually intentionally, and that's sort of the government summary, made some changes that were intended to reflect a more inclusive form. And it's supposed to be more plain English, clear form for an individual to understand what's being asked, why it's being asked. So there are things like someone's sex is no longer being asked on the form. For people who are concerned about that because of gender identity issues or sort of confidentiality, that's one area where that's not included. Some people on the law enforcement side had said, well, that's information. Sometimes we need that, right? Sometimes that's useful for us to identify this is this person and not this person. But as the PVQ points out, that's becoming less and less relevant the more someone is able to change their gender identity and even their birth certificate, you know, identified sex. So it's a whole driver's licenses, et cetera. So it becomes less relevant whether someone was a male then is a female, identifies as a male versus a female in that context. So there are a number of different changes that have been made on the form to just address that. So again, this was sort of post our publication date. The final piece I would say is the SEED guidelines. So we know the government's going to be, has expressed they have an intention at some point to relook and update the SEED guidelines when it comes to the trusted workforce reform effort that's in place. So our suggestion is when you do that, take a look at it from this perspective and at least take that into account as you're updating to ensure you're still getting all the important information you need to ensure someone's trusted, but you're not creating experiences that creates an inequitable one. And again, we have a number of at least anecdotal examples of either individuals going through this and having that experience or investigators hearing other investigators say things or do things that they're just like, bah, how could you do that? Or, you know, in some cases, investigators identifying or adjudicators identifying, hey, this person, one example was a quote unquote cross-dresser who didn't report their job and they want to disqualify the person for sexual behavior, or that's not what the intent was. It was personal conduct because they didn't declare the second job that they should have declared on their form. But the inclination was there's something bad about this sexual behavior and that's a guideline. So again, those types of things, the more clarity investigators and adjudicators can have in the process, it will help the process as a whole. And that will ultimately help the candidates who are going through the process to understand what's being asked for and to have an expectation of at least fairness and equity in the process.
The cross-dressing example is an instrument. We get a lot of spicy questions over at Clearance Jobs. And I was like, you'd be surprised what you can do if you pay your taxes. I mean, I think that is like when it comes down to it, we actually look at how the government like looks at these issues. They really are not generally, you know, making a judgment, a value judgment on your behavior. They are looking very much at rules, guidelines, outside income activities, and that's where the form catches you. So we do get into these questions where people kind of are concerned about one thing. It might be an issue, but it's probably not an issue for the reason that you think of. I thought the training piece of it was important. It made me kind of think about this process and even in terms of, you know, what would it look like for an applicant to come into the situation more informed and empowered too? And I think putting this information out there is helpful. I know the goal is to improve the government and I love that, but I like also want to educate applicants too. It's like, I ended up asking the government after this research report came out, I was like, it actually calls to mind, like, I've had a lot of issues where I might prefer to talk to a female background investigator, a background investigator of a different gender. Like, is that something that I could ask for? Or what if I'm not comfortable being alone in a room with someone of the opposite sex because of the story in my narrative? Is it okay, government? Can I ask somebody into the room? I got some conflicting, you know, kind of responses to that question, but that's where some kind of like some applicant empowerment is key too, because I found like there's nothing in the policy prohibiting you from having somebody in the room with you. Now, if you bring your lawyer with you, they're probably going to ask questions. I did get told that. But if you need a friend with you, there's nothing prohibiting it in policy. So kind of thinking through, I love kind of looking at what the policy is. And if there's not a rule saying you can't, ask what you can and bring that into the conversation. It's really helpful to kind of have those studies. So I thought this was important research just to even to think through that piece of it, which I had not thought of before.
Yeah, that's a super interesting question. Like you're talking about sort of from the trauma perspective or reasons you might feel that the comfort level and ultimately be have it be a better interview if you're not going through that. And we've actually encountered that a lot as we're looking into this question of neurodiversity and those who are neurodivergent in the process, right? What accommodations can you ask for? What sort of pieces of things, like you said, having someone in the process, you all talked a little bit about having someone help you with the form or fill out the form for you, right? But ultimately the individual is the one that's responsible for what's in the form. But there are certain candidates where you really want that person and that background and that skill set, but it may be that there are accommodations that are warranted for the government to be able to allow. And so I know in some cases they are allowed, but it's agency specific. It's different. They're at different places when it comes to even thinking about this topic. So it's important that we do have these conversations. And I think it's heartening that at least this aspect of the government is asking those questions wherever they sort of settle in what they might implement in the end.
I'm an eternal optimist, so I like to have hope. We're all coming at the Trusted Workforce 2.0 initiative at different places right now. But studies like this are encouraging to me to say, like, we are in this process of reforming what it looks like to be a trusted worker in the government. We know that we need the biggest pool of qualified applicants, which is going to include diverse applicants with different backgrounds. Can you maybe speak to how research like this ties into this overall bigger picture effort that we're kind of behind here of making a better trusted workforce?
Yes, absolutely. And it's, look, this is a challenge for the government, right? On one hand, they want to make sure they don't make any mistakes and let someone in that's going to decide to, you know, leak whatever, spy however, and they want to ensure that person's trusted and stays trusted. On the other hand, you want to get people in to do those jobs, right? It's really important for the national security mission space that you actually have individuals that can be trusted and can execute their jobs. So the Trusted Workforce 2.0, the reform effort, it seeks trying to modernize the way it collects information from individuals while improving the customer experience going through that process, right? And then adhering to principles of fairness and equity. These are the first time those have really been all articulated, I think, in one place. And so there's a lot of different moving parts to this. One is making sure that there's like better communication and information that's going out there, a two-way communication mechanism. So once you provide your information in the security clearance process, it isn't a void of information for 6 months and then suddenly spits out a decision, right? So I think there's a positive when it comes to that. And so this is another piece, I think, when we talk about this aspect of things. In the end, the goal of personnel vetting is to get trusted individuals in the door executing the national security mission, whether as a government employee or a contractor from a cleared workforce. And the government doesn't want to deter qualified candidates, some of whom have needed skill sets and cultural knowledge. And that means they're going to come from some more diverse backgrounds or more diverse, even again, sort of intellectual perspectives on things. And so the efforts like this are intended to, what the government can do is make sure the process is well understood, that it's fair and equitable, and encourages candidates to apply and go through the process rather than deters them from the process because of how complicated it will be, or again, their worry about the potential for bias or inequity, because some of these questions that are asked are deeply personal. They do get into a lot of really tough questions for the individual. But in the end, you know, if candidates can go through this process, understand what they should expect and how they should be treated and what their rights are in the process, the better the possibility we'll be able to grow its talent base and meet the national security needs that they have today and tomorrow as that continues to evolve.
I love that. You're talking my love language, because I do feel like the government's diversity numbers can kind of lie when it comes to these things, because so many candidates will opt out of the process because it is intimidating to them. So kind of the more we can kind of destigmatize just the notion of, hey, we actually want diverse applicants to apply, because right now you have a barrier to entry at the application phase where just people aren't willing to like put their step through the door. So then they're not even considered in terms of who's making it through, because we're not getting them. We're not getting to the starting point. So I think research like this is important to signal like, hey, the government does care. They are looking at the process. They are saying, how can we do this better? PVQ is taking steps in the right direction. Better training for investigators will help. And then again, just getting research like this out there. So on that note, I very much appreciate your time. I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me. The work you guys do is important over there at RAND, and I certainly love to read about it.
Thank you so much, Lindy. We appreciate you having us and letting us talk about this topic that we care deeply about. So thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of ClearedCast. Hit the subscribe button and share this episode with your friends and colleagues. For more security clearance updates and national security career advice, subscribe to news.clearancejobs.com. If you have an active clearance, refresh your profile and search Clear Careers at clearancejobs.com.